Hello, I'm Tony Collins and this is the Rugby Reloaded podcast. Today I'm talking to Dr. Victoria Dawson, the historian behind the Life Without League Diary project, which is asking rugby league fans to write a diary of their lives in the time of coronavirus, when the game has been suspended and its immediate future is uncertain. The diaries will be deposited in the RFL archives at the University of Huddersfield, where they will be a resource for future historians and researchers. Victoria is best known as a historian of women's involvement in rugby league and is currently working on a book on the subject. She's also collecting the memories of women who went to Wembley for the Challenge Cup final before 1975. We began by talking, on a very, very scratchy Skype connection, about her fascinating work on the long history of women's involvement in the sport. And I started by asking her how she goes about researching women's hidden history and what motivates her to do the work.
I'm currently writing up the research that I've done on women's involvement in rugby league. And I'm also doing an extension to that research in looking for women who have been to Wembley before 1975 and getting their experiences of going to a Challenge Cup final. One of the biggest myths is that women have never had anything to do with sport. And just because women haven't been playing, whether it's rugby or soccer or, they've played the odd game here and there, that sport is essentially a male domain. And if I'd had a pound for every time somebody said to me, yeah, but there have been no women in rugby league. And it's like, well, actually, I've just proved them all wrong. Women have been there, and it's about uncovering those unacknowledged contributions by women. And it's not just about sport. I mean, it's happened in all walks of life across the world. You know, women's contributions have largely gone unrecognised and certainly haven't been put on the historic record until feminist historians started to look for the evidence and document it. And it's, for me, it's about adding truth to the historic record, I think. And, you know, that truth can sometimes be hard to find, but it's really important that we actually start doing that and recognise that there are multiple stories and multiple strands of history that just haven't been explored or documented. And for me, I think that's the overall driver for me. There's a lot of trawling the archives, looking for tiny, tiny bits of information, and also looking at other sources too. So not just looking in the RFL archive at the game's official records, but I've uncovered things in things like asylum records. Newspapers have been a fantastic resource, and they've sort of led me on different paths, like looking at the different records, like asylum records. I've looked at cookbooks even. I think what I enjoy about, your work as well as doing my own is actually putting that into context, because a lot of writing about sport doesn't seem to do that. It seems to pay lip service to the fact that sport exists, exists in a much wider context, and other things affect sport just like sport affects other things in people's lives. And I think as well that being able to put women's contributions for me into the wider context of women's history is also really important, because I just think that's something that doesn't get done enough. It's about what does it tell us about the wider world, for me, is always the overarching question. And it's not just the facts, the figures, the rules, who was the first team, who was the first to do X, Y, or Z. It's well, what does all this is all interesting information on one level, but what does it tell us about the bigger picture? And for me, that's the fantastic part about doing what we do as historians. It's about putting it into that context.
I mean, you actually discovered the first ever organised women's rugby league match as well, which I think is a fantastic, not only a fantastic piece of research, it's also it's hugely important for the game as a whole.
Yeah, the Marsh and Key women, that actually came from somebody had left a scrapbook in the archive, and amongst all of these bits of newspaper cuttings that somebody had lovingly spent years and years pasting into scrapbooks, there it was, just nestled in a corner, this idea that there were some women in Workington playing rugby league. And it wasn't particularly flattering, this article, but that set me off on a, you know, on a chase for them. And then I ended up actually interviewing some women who took part. And that for me was fantastic, to speak to these women who had no idea that they'd created history. And, you know, they were, every single one of them was lovely. We spent hours chatting, and it was a real privilege to listen to not just what they'd done in rugby league, but their life stories, and to find out what life was like for them in this very poor part of Workington, and to put it into that context. Here were these women from, you know, an area that had been designated a slum, that they felt was part of their DNA, this Marsh and Key place in Workington, which had such importance to them and who they were and who they are. And it was a real privilege to sort of go on that journey and to track some women down and chat to them and actually shed some light on their achievements at the time. And, you know, they'd not done it because they were diehard rugby league fans and it was about playing the sport for the sport's sake, but it was bigger than that. It was about the community and it was about helping their community at the time. And it was just about what it told you about the area and about the region and about women's lives in general. And it was a lovely piece of work to work on.
Yeah, I think that's a great example of how, with rugby league history, and I'm not saying this isn't the case with other sports, but I think it's much more on the surface. You're never very far from the social history or community history of a place or a group of people, because partly because of the way that rugby league grew up, partly because of its where it's located. And I think that's the the stuff that you discovered on the Marsh and Key women in Workington and the other stuff. It demonstrates that, yeah, again, like you were saying earlier on, it's the context that's everything. It's a way of illuminating the way people live their lives, as much as it is, you know, great deeds of try scoring and cup winning on the pitch.
Yeah, which and the stories are fantastic in themselves, but for me, the context is everything. That's where the interesting stuff is. It's about what does it tell us about the wider world, and what does it tell us about people's lives in general. And for me, that's where the exciting thinking and the exciting stuff is. The voices of the working class in general, you know, we haven't had our stories told all that often. Official records don't reflect what working class people think and feel and how things affect us. You know, the archives lack working class voices in all areas of life. And that's something that I think, you know, our research into rugby league has actually managed to, it's our small contribution in a way to wider history, in that, you know, by default, because rugby league is born of a class conflict, and, you know, our research has contributed some working class voices. You know, it's starting to fill a hole, and it tells its story of what it's like to be, you know, a working class person in the north, or in, you know, Wales or South Wales even. You know, and even some histories of the north omit rugby league. And it's very frustrating when that happens, because it's such a part of the fabric of who we are. And even if you are not interested in rugby league, in terms of the wider story of the people of the north of England, it's absolutely there, as, you know, it's as important as all of the other things that are classed as stereotypically northern.
Even if you look at the RFL archives, there's not many voices of people. There's lots of official records, the minute books, finance records and things like that. But in terms of the actual voice of players or spectators, or even officials for that matter, it's very hard to get their authentic voices, because archives aren't really set up to do that. And, you know, these are things that people want to record at the time.
Part of my research has been about trying to collate some of this material so that it can you know, once it's been written up, be deposited there, and to start addressing the massive gap in, you know, in voices and in the archive, whether it's players, whether it's, you know, the experiences of match officials and coaches and definitely spectators. I mean, again, programmes can only tell you so much. They're an official record. They're a business output. But what we need is, is first person testimony as to what things were like at any given time. I mean, I don't know about you, but there are definitely things that I wish existed in the archive. So, for example, in 1877, Isabella Boardman, who had a pub, the Bridge Inn in Salford, she let Broughton Rangers, who were just forming, use her pub as their base. And we know that she contributed to the club. They thought very highly of her. We know that she lent players money. But to have a diary of somebody like her from so far back that could tell us what it was like being a woman at that time, what it was like when she was widowed the first time round, and how she got involved and what that club meant to her. We can tell from newspapers and from what the club had said about her that they felt very highly of her. But to have her testimony and to know whether she did indeed invest in the club itself, whether, you know, she ended up, you know, what she did for the club beyond just letting them use their pub, and would be just give us so much more in terms of, you know, what life was like for women at the time, especially women in business. We know she died with a lot of money, so how the heck she did that, you know, as a working class woman. And it would just tell us so much more, and it would be fantastic to have stuff like that. And I really wish there had been a culture of working class women writing diaries. And, you know, if we think about technology now, the capacity we have to record our thoughts and feelings, and if that had existed then, and we could actually go back and speak to these people, it'd just be, fantastic for people like us.
You can imagine what it would have been like to have a diary of a player who was around in 1895, or someone like, particularly someone, you know, a big star like Dickie Lockwood, who switched in 1895, but was also had been put on trial by the RFU for professionalism in the 1880s, and then became captain of England.
You see, I'd be more interested in his wife. I'd be interested in how that affects like his family as well. You know, to have to go through that and to support your husband through that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the other thing that's interesting, because he was a classic rugby player who was given a pub to run by, I think it would have been by Wakefield after the split. And he went bankrupt very quickly because, you know, he obviously didn't have the business skills to run a pub. So you wonder what his wife and kids thought of that. And then he had to go back and work as a manual labourer and ended up dying in 1915 when he was only relatively young. I don't think he was even 50 when he died. And obviously in those days, that would have left his family in penury, basically. So you've got that whole thing, you know, as you've pointed out in your work about the support that players are given by, their wives, mothers, their families, the female members of their family. So, the insights that you could have by that. And as you say, that's true of all working class life as well. Unfortunately, people just don't have the time or the space to record their thoughts.
And also the, you know, women spectators. So, you know, that first record of women spectators in 1883. I mean, we know they were going before then, but it's to have testimonies of women to say, well, why did you go? Because we all have, you know, women are all different. We all have different reasons for doing whatever it is we do. And all rugby league women will have a different reason for going to matches. But to know back then as well, when it was, gender roles were very different to what they are now, to know what made them go, what they were interested in and what they found exciting about a game, you know, the social element as well, and whether it was a place that they did go to because they could meet friends or and things like that. It would be lovely to be able to speak to those early women spectators as well and to find out why they went and what they thought and whether it was important in their lives. Because, you know, for a lot of people, you know, rugby league, there are a lot of diehard fans who will go in any kind of weather, especially if you're a Hull fan. you know, but it ebbs and flows for some people, and, you know, for women as well, you know, did it get interrupted by family concerns and things like that? And to know that kind of stuff and to be able to look back and see what it was like and compare it with now as well and see what actually is, are there some similarities between, you know, the way women lived their lives then and the way women live their lives now and the concerns that we have, is would be really fascinating. And I wish that there were, you know, spectators.
I mean, there are occasionally diaries by players. I mean, there was one, Harold Bowman, the Hull player, went on tour to Australia with Great Britain in 1928, wrote a diary that Mike Ullier in Hull published. And that was, although it wasn't that personal or anything, that was really fascinating just in terms of the way he related to what was going on around him and going to Australia in 1928 at a time when, you know, unless you were emigrating for good or you were in the army, you know, working class people didn't go abroad at all, really. And you think that, you know, if you'd had another, you know, other diaries like that, that even if they're not describing the things you necessarily wanted to talk about, you can create that bigger picture just through their personal experiences. And I think that's important as well. It's not just a question of what people talk about. Sometimes it's often what they don't talk about or what they just take for granted.
You know, you can get a lot about, you can, again, it's about the context, you can get a lot about wider lives and geography and you know, things that are, diaries also tell people what's important to the writer, you know, so what a writer chooses to put in is actually quite indicative of what's important to them, and, you know, and sometimes what's, like you say, what's not in there is also quite interesting. Diaries can be, they're always subjective, but they can give us details and that you just can't get anywhere else. So what if you could have anything in an archive, what do you wish you could have found in the archive?
Well, I think as I said earlier on, I mean, if players like Dickie Lockwood had kept a diary, but I think anything, even just personal, because I mean, I think, by and large, we know the broad outlines of the facts of the history of rugby league and before the split. You know, we know what decisions were made by what governing bodies and how people respond, how the clubs and the other organisations responded to that. But what we don't have really is how people felt about it. There's a little bit in newspaper reports, and you can obviously gather in newspaper reports that the decision of the rugby union to become an amateur body in 1886 wasn't popular with players, and the split of the Northern Union was very popular with players and spectators. But we don't really know how people felt like that, apart from one or two people who wrote to newspapers. And so it would just be very interesting to have people's thoughts on a day-to-day basis about what was going on.
Yeah, I mean, and people just had different lives then, and you know, what may seem really mundane about our lives now, if you like, you know, whether it's what we get up and how we have, what we have for breakfast and the fact that we shop in supermarkets and things like that, may seem really mundane to us, but there will come a time when that doesn't happen anymore, when the way humanity lives its life is very different to what it is now. And, you know, if you think about the historians in the next 100, 150 years, what would they want to know about now, really? And it's, you know, it's exactly the same as to what we would like to know about, you know, the time pre-split and around the split or in the early 20th century. The current situation has definitely made me think about, you know, this is something that we're living through, and actually we are living through what will become history. And it's an unprecedented time, and, you know, a lot of things are happening in a very, you know, very quickly, and there's a lot of changes. And, you know, in January, none of us would have ever imagined that rugby league would have been suspended. You know, everyone was looking forward to the season, you know, for different reasons. Everyone, you know, had the teams that they were following, and everyone hated Wigan. And, you know, it's just one of those, you know, everything was going on as normal. And then here we are at the start of April, and none of us have seen, you know, a live rugby league game for a couple of weeks, and we're all dealing with it differently, and none of us know what's going to happen going forward. Is there going to be a season this season? Are we going to get cancelled until next year? How, you know, what's going to be the financial repercussions of what we're going through now? So it's really interesting to consider these questions, I think, because as historians, but as we are living through history now.
And I suppose that leads us on to the Life Without League project, which is all about recording your memories of what's going on now as a rugby league supporter and how it's impacted on your life.
Yeah, because we are living through history, and we don't really, because it's happening to us now, we just have no idea whether this is going to be a blip or whether it's going to be something that has much more far-reaching consequences for not only our own lives, but also the sport. And really, you know, thinking back to the split, I mean, people would have just dealt with it as it happened, and, you know, whether it was clubs and players and families who were, you know, dealing with all those ramifications. And really, this is another one of those times. And, you know, as a historian, thinking about, well, what do I wish that I could go to in an archive to tell me about a particular period or a particular event? And this is going to be one of those times. So for me, really, it was about thinking, hang on a minute. You know, no one else, and no other sport is doing this as far as I can tell. And, you know, rugby league, we've always been innovative, and we've got a real opportunity here to, as a community, to the rugby league family, to sort of come together and say, do you know what, we're going to make a real conscious effort to add to our own history in a way that the likes of us wishes people had done 125 years ago.
Yeah, and I think the other thing that relates to that is that we don't know what's going to be important to future historians. And I think you go back and say you're looking at the 19th century, and any little snippet for us, looking back from the 21st century, any little snippet of information helps to create a bigger, a more illuminating picture. And it's the same today. We don't know how future historians are going to view the present times or how they're going to look back on it. And obviously, they're going to have the benefit of hindsight, which we don't have. And, you know, people in contemporary times don't. It's only later on that you can actually really understand what was going on. So I think that's the other thing about, you know, diaries, that it's just something you put everything down, how you're feeling, what's going on, events as they take place or as you see them. And then whilst that is, you know, quite often a really good cathartic thing for people to do anyway, it's good, it's good therapy in a sense. But the value of that in 25 years time, 50 years time, 100 years time, who knows? I mean, you know, it could be the stuff of lots and lots of books. It could be one of the most illuminating things about this period. So I think that's the other thing. The information that you put down on paper now, or you record, or however you record it, you never know how valuable it's going to be in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the more people can contribute, even if it's just a few lines. I mean, it doesn't, you know, nobody has to write a novel, but even if they just write a few lines about, you know, what life without league is like at this time, and, you know, just whether they're having to, you know, if it's people that are working from home, whether it's people that are still having to go out to work because they're key workers, but, you know, whether they've been at a complete loss without rugby league, or whether it's just like, well, actually, it's okay, it's not affecting us. Whether people think they've got something to contribute or not, all of it is useful. And it's not just about players and, you know, employees of the game, but, you know, volunteers, supporters, people who, you know, support people who are in the game even, you know, anybody who has any connection to the game. The more information we get down now, like you say, can be cathartic on a personal level, but all it does is it helps us and future historians and of future historians understand a lot more about rugby league, its cultural significance at this time, and, you know, what people are feeling now about where the game might go. None of us know, but it's going to be absolutely fascinating, you know, in 5 and 10 years time, when, you know, the effects of what is going on now is sort of a lot known a lot more. But just to see what the debates were and what people's concerns were, because it may be that we've got nothing to worry about and the game is going to be fine. It might be, you know, worst case scenario is that it has a catastrophic effect. And so now, as we're going through all of this, as, you know, as individuals and as a community based around a sport, it's absolutely fascinating to think of what the potential is for people, if people write down their thoughts and their feelings now and how it's affecting them, and how that can in the future really shed some light on this time and our sport. You know, again, it's all about the context and our sport and its place in, not only in, you know, in the North, but in the country and in a global context as well.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. So what should people do if they want to keep a diary?
The website is lifewithoutleague.wordpress.com. There are different ways to keep a diary. They can download a Word document or a PDF to a device and complete it and email it in. There's also an online submission form. It's very easy. Like I say, you know, you can write as little or as much as you like. You can keep one diary entry and that'll be it. Or you could do it every day or every week or even every couple of weeks, you know, or whenever you remember is absolutely fantastic. But would absolutely encourage anybody to write a diary. Really, we want adults to write these diaries, and, you know, whether they're players or volunteers, whether it's just that their kids play, and, you know, parents are saying, well, you know, my child plays and they're absolutely dying to get back out to see their mates, and, you know, they love doing it on a weekend or a night after school, and it's really frustrating because, you know, my kids are tearing around the place and climbing the walls and, you know, we can't wait to get back, or, you know, whatever it is, whatever anyone's experience is, even if people aren't really that bothered, you know, it doesn't matter. You know, we're all interested in the sport or not interested in the sport for different reasons. And whatever it is that anyone thinks, everybody is interesting. And I hear a lot of people going, oh, well, my life's really boring, you know, I don't really have anything to say, and that's actually not true. And it's like you said earlier, you know, the things that people find interesting in the future will be very different to the things that we find interesting today. So any snippet of information that we can get down now will, going forward, really contribute to the overall history of the game and of the you know, the time that we live in now.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think the watchword is I couldn't agree more. I think the watchword has got to be start writing and keep writing, because you never know what it's going to lead to.
Yeah, but again, you know, our lives are very different, and if people just want to write one entry, it is better than no entry at all. So I would just encourage people to write, you know, one diary entry, and it's a few lines. It's better than no diary entry. So I would encourage people to submit multiple diary entries as this progresses, at times that suits them. But definitely, if everyone could just do as one, we would have such a wealth of information going forward. And it will be absolutely fascinating to see how people's thoughts and feelings and hopes and fears change as this really quite bizarre situation unfolds.
Brilliant. I couldn't agree more. Thanks very much. I hope you've enjoyed listening to this episode of the Rugby Reloaded podcast. If you want to take part in the Life Without League diary projects, and I'd encourage everyone to do so, go to lifewithoutleague.wordpress.com for more information. And you can also follow the project on Twitter via @lifewithoutrl. For more details about Victoria's project on rugby league women going to Wembley between 1950 and 1975, go to wembleywomen.wordpress.com. And it's also on Twitter @WembleyWomenRL. And as I'm sure you know by now, my Twitter handle is @ColinsTony, and my website is www.rugbyreloaded.com, where you can dip into the complete archive of all past episodes of this podcast. Until next week, stay safe and keep well.